Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is World Form Zen Fighting Champion John Chung, and you're listening to the AMAA Legends and Pioneers Radio Blog Show with Professor Gary Lee and the Sport Karate Museum Archives, connecting the history one warrior at a time. Enjoy.
Aloha, mahalo, everybody, and welcome to the AMAA Masters in Radio Pioneer Show. And tonight I have a very special show. I've got some really special guests, and we'll be bringing them on here in a little bit. But first of all, I want to introduce you to my producer for the past 5 years who's putting us on the air, and he's got so many cool things going on. I'd like for him to share with you now. Jesse Bowen, sir.
Hello, sir. How are you doing?
Good, sir. How are you doing tonight?
Better and better. We're all very blessed. You know, number one, if we're on this show tonight and we're healthy, you know, that we're blessed. And, you know, we're trying to just keep moving forward with the American Martial Arts Alliance. In this past week with all the different things that's happening in the world with the virus and, you know, what you do, a lot of decisions have to be made. And, you know, we made a real big decision this past week, and that is to actually host our event as a virtual event. You know, to my knowledge, I don't know anyone that's tried that, you know, this with the virus and everything. We've had technology in now, it's way in front of us, and we have to think creative. The book is very important because the book is about telling the story, sharing the history of individuals, and as we have lost several martial artists to the virus, it's even more important, and I'm even more committed to publishing the book and getting the book out there. So we're going to be bringing all of our people together, same as we would do in Vegas, but we're going to be bringing them together online for them to share their story, their journey, their celebration with the world, not just as a, and not just in a venue that most people wouldn't have had a chance to come to. So we can now be able to share that, you know, with the world. We have, so we have such a great event that's going to be coming out. We're going to be letting everyone know as we're putting everything together, we're bringing together several organizations that possibly wouldn't have been working together, but that's how we are now in the world. And, you know, we're working together and trying to, you know, find a good place for everyone. So, you know, okay, we're going to keep you informed. We got some really positive things going on. But again, the date is still going to be June the 27th, the release of the book. Again, we're excited about the opportunity to honor Mr. Norris and Benny, and it's going to be a great event, sir. So we're going to keep you informed. I know you got some super fantastic guests you're going to have on the show tonight, so I'm going to turn it back over to you.
Well, thank you so much, and we appreciate you actually being our producer for the past 5 years and introducing the Sport Karate Museum through your vision and through your book and through the icons and pioneers that we work with daily. God bless you, Jesse Bowen. You're one of the good guys. Well, guys, I'm so excited about tonight because people have sent me emails and contacted me through the past many years and asked me how did I learn how to do some of the things I do about promoting and putting things together for people. Well, tonight I have two of my heroes and mentors that actually showed me through their work what they've done for America, how I've become what I've become through the Sport Karate Museum. And then I've got a special surprise guest. So first of all, I want to tell you that I've got the first guest is Mr. George Minshew from the Karate Olympics, famous from Houston, Texas, and Mr. Joe Corley from the inventor of the Battle of Atlanta, two of the most prolific promoters that America has ever seen, and we'll be talking to them. But the surprise guest is none other than Miss Chris Minshew. Now, this woman is incredible. She's not only an amazing teacher, She is the only woman to ever win the Super Grand World Championship twice. And I've got her on the air, too. So right off the bat, guys, hello, Mr. Courtney. Hello, Mr. Minshew. Hello, Chris.
Hi, guys.
Aloha.
Hello, everyone. Well,
thank you, Gary,
well, listen,
for coming up.
Well, thank you. Well, right off the bat, I want permission to ask Mr. Courtney and Mr. Minshew, may I call Mr. Minshew George and Mr. Courtney Joe? May I do that, guys?
Please, please do that.
We must have
a very bad
connection.
Oh, really? Why?
What word did he use? George. Hello.
Grandmaster.
Knock yourself out, Gary.
George,
we're all friends here,
sorry,
buddy.
Okay. Well, I'm going to introduce you guys individually and let you talk a little bit. Then we're going to have a free-for-all question-and-answer train. First of all, I want to introduce Chris. Chris, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good, Gary. Thanks. How are
good.
You?
Well, tell me. I'm doing fine, honey. Tell me a little about your career when you first started and your fighting years and maybe some of your bullet points that you've done in sport karate.
Well, I started at the Black Belt Academy probably in about 1984 and made Black Belt in 1988. And did many, many different circuits and competed, you know, like everybody on the circuit, weekend after weekend, and loved every minute of it for sure. Met a lot of great friends all around, and it was just a great time.
You were all around the world, yeah. You got to fight a lot of people. And, you know, I think I'm going to say this publicly. Chris, I believe that you're probably one of the most underrated fighters that we ever had in America as far as women fighters. God bless you. You are a beast.
Oh, thank you.
You were sweet, but you were a beast. Well,
he is a
God
beast.
Bless George,
for sure.
Well, God bless. Well, there he is. Everybody, that's George Minshew. George, tell my listeners how you started and who influenced you, and we'll talk about the tournament a little bit later, but what did you make Bob on?
Well, you know, my early time in martial arts really started with the back pages of comic books where you would see Bruce Tegner. Some of the guys may recognize that name, and he would tell you how to keep somebody from kicking sand in your face or beating you up or doing all that stuff. And I thought, well, God, that's secret stuff. I'd really like to know that stuff. But nobody really, there was just no place that you could learn that. And then when I moved to Houston, I discovered a karate school, a guy named Jim Arwood, who was a terrific martial artist and when he was in the Air Force Intelligence Division, he was training in Japan. That's where he earned his first degree and second degree in Japan, and then came back after he got out of the military and came to Houston and opened up a karate school. It was called Japan Ways, and I went down there for a free one lesson thing, and I never left. I just I fell in love with it. And I, from that day forward, I never missed a day in the karate school.
Now, your president and instructor is the legendary J. Pat Burleson. How did you get hooked up with Mr. Burleson?
I tell you what, I'm just the luckiest guy in the world to be able to have done that. I met Grandmaster Burleson in, I think it was in 1964, 65, somewhere in there. And I he was in Fort Worth and I was in Houston, but I drove up to Fort Worth to help him a little bit with his business because I was working in the karate school from the day I went in. I told you, for that free trial lesson, and I didn't have any money, but I did have skills. So I started working in the karate school and trying to help them learn how to make a business out of what they were doing. And so when I met Pat Burleson to Fort Worth, and he was he was way ahead of his time. I can tell you for sure. He was running his business like he using some of the techniques he learned at the Fred Astaire dance studio across the street. So he would go to their meetings and take some of their information and transfer it into karate classes. So he was way ahead of his time for sure. And then I was lucky enough to be able to help him build on that. And we became instant friends and have been ever since. And that was, God, I don't know, 50 something years ago. And he was, matter of fact, he was the best man when Chris and I got married.
Yes, sir. Well, yeah, I want to talk about your illustrious history and career, not only in doing karate, but running schools and running the largest tournaments in America. And of course, being behind the microphone, but I've got to go to my other guest. Mr. Corey, Joe, are you there, sir?
I am still here.
Yes, sir. Well, can you tell us a little bit how you got started and some of your highlights, what you've done besides the Battle of Atlanta, but some of your fighting career? A lot of people don't realize that you were an awesome fighter before you became this awesome promoter. So tell me a little about your beginning history, sir.
Well, I started when I was 16. I made black belt when I was 19. We opened the first school when I was 19. And then we started the Battle of Atlanta 3 years after that, and ran the Battle of Atlanta up until 2013, at which time we turned it over to Greg Ruth. And, you know, along the way, we got a chance to do some television through PKA on many of the networks and, you know, got a chance to meet just some really great people over the years, you know, all the way from, you know, Jeff Smith and Bill Wallace and our former, you know, now lost to us friend Joe Lewis, and just so many great people over the years. And then the last 10 years or so got to get elevated to the, I think I'm called an adopted Texan now. So I got to finally meet George Minshew.
really
learned the ropes of life. And George Minshew has taught me more than anybody could ever imagine since I met those guys. So it's been great.
Well, I'm so excited. I feel like a kid on Christmas morning having two of my heroes on the line on the air. And then having Chris Minshew on the line, which kicked me in the head many times for demos and demonstrations. And, you know, it's just exciting. So I'm going to kind of make it a free-for-all. But first of all, I want to ask a personal question since it's called Parts Unknown. Mr. George, have you ever been called Tony Orlando any times? He looked just like that.
Yes, and I got a note from Tony Orlando saying, thanking me for people mistaking him for George Minshew.
Okay. Well, the other question I got to ask, the hard question to Mr. Joe, is that who does your hair? Because back in the 70s, you were known to have a beautiful haircut, I guess, an afro. I mean, that's incredible. You were more known for your hair and your gentlemanly ways and say you're fighting, but I got proof of pictures of you bowing into somebody, and then the next moment I got a picture of you, that guy's being knocked out. I know that story, but tell me about your hair. Who does your hair?
You know, I went to a military school for 10 years, and in the military school you weren't allowed to have the hair touch your ears, so when I left... When I left the military school after I graduated from there, I let my hair get longer, and I was a big Neil Diamond fan, and I liked the way that Neil Diamond's hair looked. So I went to a hairstylist, Mr. Minshew. That's HairStylist. I went to a hairstylist, and I said, I want my hair to look like this. And so he straightened my hair, which was wavy and curly, and that's the way it looked. And I'm sure it was that and a little bit of the real Southern charm that allowed me to have one of my most favorite days in Houston down there when I was fighting in the
tournament. Your nickname when you were fighting was Gentleman Joe Corey. So that kind of makes that. I got one more serious question for Chris, and then we'll go to some fun questions. Serious question for Chris Minichie. Chris, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay. You're one of the best fighters, I said, and everyone knows around back in the 90s. Now, the serious question I got to ask you is, you know, you were under one of the greatest coaches we've ever had, and you also had to be married to him. What was that like?
Well, I'll tell you what. I just knew when I was fighting, if I just listened, I knew that I would perform well. You know, Mr. Minichie would, I mean, he could just tell me anything to do. If I hadn't even practiced it or trained it in months, I knew if I just listened and I did what he said that he saw the openings and the different things that I needed to do. So I truly have to give it all to him. I had some talent, but a lot of it was him telling me what to do. Thing is, we would, you know, like we would go to a tournament and I'd probably fought this girl, I don't know, easy 10 times. And he'd say, Chris, what's the first thing she's going to do? What's her first technique? And I go, I don't know. What? He's like, you fought her 10 times. What is she going to do? So I just knew I had to listen.
Well, he was a great coach. And that was a hard question. So let's have some fun questions now. Now, first of all, George, now you had one of the largest karate tournaments in America. You know, I mean, did you have that vision in the beginning to grow so big? I mean, because the Karate Olympics was amazing in Texas. And then, of course, in the early years, you had people that fought in it, that all Joe Louis, a lot of people that competed in it. John Wilson, a lot of cool people. What vision did you have when it began?
Well, you know, to build an event, and you were right in your early introduction, Joe Corley set the bar so high as far as developing a tournament, which was way more than a tournament. And that's also what I was trying to do with the Karate Olympics, is to have a time and a place that people that maybe would only go to one tournament a year, and I wanted them to pick my tournament as the one they would go to. And that's how you build a tournament, not by the guy that will bring you 10 or 15 or 20 students, by the 20 people that will bring you 10 students. That's how you build, you know, that's how you build the size of your event. And, you know, one of the early things that I remember about Joe Corley is I went to a little tournament in Louisiana, and they had maybe 100 competitors, but I would go to every tournament I could and put my flyers out and meet people and invite them to come down and make them know that if they came to my event, they would be treated with the special way that they deserved. And this little tournament in somewhere in South Louisiana, and all of a sudden in walked Joe Corley. And I walked up to him. I didn't know him well, but we knew each other. And I said, Joe, why are you here from Atlanta? And he said, the same reason you are, man. We're trying to build our tournament. So we were both on the same path, and thankful every day that I have that relationship with Joe, and I was able to learn so much from him.
Well, thank you.
Well,
so, Mr. Courtney, now, Joe, tell me about your vision of the Battle of Atlanta. I mean, you turned that into one of the it was the mainstay for a lot of tournaments for many years. And you just, I can't even put into words what you did for so many people. Because the one thing I know about George Minichie and Joe Corley is that you guys really care. So, Joe, tell me about your vision, how to make it so big and so possible to other people. I mean, people were talking about one time, there'd be like 76, 80 people in one division. That's incredible.
Well, I guess all of us know by this time in life that, you know, the karma says you'll basically get paid back for what it is that you do for other people. And my real motivation in starting the Battle of Atlanta was to make it a fair fighting place for anybody that came from anywhere, because as I traveled around the country and competed, I saw that there was really very powerful regional bias everywhere you went. And so in the very first Battle of Atlanta, I made a special effort to invite Joe Lewis in from the West Coast, and then we were fortunate enough to have Glenn Keeney and Bill Wallace come down from the Midwest, and then we had a bunch of the New York guys come down from the Korean circuit, and then we had some guys come up from Florida. And we only had 23 black belts in that first tournament, but we had about 13 of the top-rated people in the country competing. And then when Joe Lewis won the tournament, and he won it with Korean judges, and he won it against Mitchell Bobrow fighting, and then fighting Joe Hayes for the grand championship, then the other thing that I did really well, and I think Mr. Minshew would appreciate this, is I went to a modeling school, and I got 50 really attractive models to come as my guests that night to the event, and the competitors were really happy. So I'm not really sure whether it was the fair competition or the fair maiden, you know, Southern Belles that kicked off that.
Well, that's where I got my idea to get all the girls from Hooters to come into the Legends one year, and everybody loved that. So I got the idea.
I was going to say that's the difference between Gentleman Joe from Atlanta and George from Houston, because I went around and visited the strip joints and got the strippers to come out to the tournament.
Okay. Well, yeah, you know, guys, right. I got a lot of emails when people found out I was going to have George Minshew and Joe Corley on the air. So the magic question that most people want to ask, in this time of crisis right now that America is going through, what can you tell the listeners how to keep their karate schools going and up and going and keep them people motivated? So, George, you can go first, and Mr. Corley, and Chris, throw your two cents in.
Yeah, go
all
right, ahead, George.
I can tell you the very most important thing for a school owner to do right now is keep communication with his students. That's vital, because training in the martial arts, like doing any other thing, is a habit. People are in a habit of coming to the karate school two or three or four times a week, whatever it is, or once. But if you break that training habit completely, they will find other things that they find interesting, and it'll be hard to get them back into the martial arts. So you want to keep in touch with them with text and with email and phone calls and any other ways that you can communicate. And have video lessons that you can teach simple things that quite often you don't have time to teach in your karate school setting. For example, I doubt if most karate schools teach people how to properly fold and roll their karate gi. But there's a way to do it so that when you take that rolled up karate uniform up, it has no wrinkles. And there's a way to do it, but most people don't have time to teach that. So that could be a very interesting and fun lesson that they could do while they're watching the video, or suggest some books or read some chapters from some interesting books, like, some book about some American samurai or whatever that.
You were before for that. You know what that is.
and do that and teach. What is the name when you fold the paper up and it becomes like a duck
origami.
Or whatever? Origami.
Origami. Origami.
Yeah, not tsunami, Joe. It's origami.
Right. Yeah,
so you know that would be an interesting lesson. So there are a lot of things that you can teach that will help them and keep them involved in the karate school.
Joe, now, what would you tell people?
I would tell people to go online to Martial Arts Wealth Mastery with Stephen Oliver and Jeff Smith, and they are giving weekly lessons to karate school owners all over the country. They're actually doing two or three open lessons a week, and they have all of their school owners teaching their regular classes online by way of Zoom. And they're even enrolling students online. They're teaching them an introductory lesson, private lesson with a one-on-one online, and enrolling the people there, and then traveling to the people's house and, you know, giving them their introductory kit and all of that stuff. So they've been a real lifesaver for so many of those schools who just were really at a loss for what to do. But it's Stephen Oliver's Wealth Mastery on Facebook, and Jeff Smith and Steve Oliver will have 40, 50, 60 schools online at a time, and you can ask any questions you want, but I strongly recommend them.
Well, I got a question for us from my listeners. You've been known to hang out with some pretty cool people. Two particular people are world champion Jeff Smith and world champion Bill Wallace. And you guys together, along with people like Don Willis and Libby Cantrell, helping you now, you created something many years ago and was a head spokesman for the PKA, the Professional Karate Association. Tell me a little about what you're doing with that now and what the people you're reaching around the world.
Well, actually, the PKA was created by Mike Anderson, and he put on the first PKA World Championship with it was an idea that Joe Lewis had, you know, to go to full contact karate. And I was just a judge at that first event. And then I was a fighter, then fought Bill Wallace in 1975 at the Battle of Atlanta. And then I wanted to continue fighting, but in those days the fights were few and far between. And just as a, you know, as a, just almost like I don't know what you'd call it, almost like an epiphany. A person from CBS hired me to do commentary on the first fight I ever called was the night that Bill Wallace fought Blinky Rodriguez, and then Benny Urquidez fought Howard Jackson. So Benny was the first fight I ever called. And when that event happened, the Quines enlisted me to become their partners in the PKA, and then I was a partner with them from 1977 to 1985, and then we had a pretty big split up and all that. But anyway, the sport built and built and built all the way up through 1994, and in 1994, we had a great event that we built up to Terrio versus Rufus. And it was a pay-per-view event, and Al Gore had not quite invented the internet yet, so we had to promote it the old-fashioned way. So what happened was I curled up into a fetal position for about the next 9 years, and during that time, the UFC came and was on a kind of a final leg, and then Dana White and the Fertitta brothers came in and bought the UFC and then put a bunch of money into it with Spike TV and so forth. But then it was just this last year where we decided to come back out and do something special with the PKA library and possibly move forward with PKA fights. And so it was at that time that we rebranded the PKA and the PKA Worldwide. And so we're working with people around the world right now on ways to either follow through with just an organization or an organization that ends up with full contact fights or kickboxing matches and perhaps even a point circuit at some point in time. But that's all to be determined. Right now, we're just doing a membership-based organization.
Well, that's exciting, and I know – I'm very excited about being a part of the PKA and some of my fellow history generals. Now, Mr. George, years ago, you were involved with the AKBBA. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. and also involved with an equipment company called ProTech with your good friend Fred Wren. Tell me about the AKBBA.
Yeah, well, the AKBBA was developed from another organization called the Southwest Karate Black Belt Association that was basically Alan Steen's students. And then he decided that he wanted to expand it into more of a national association, so he changed the name from the Southwest Karate Black Belt Association to the American Karate Black Belt Association. And Alan Steen and Pat Burleson and myself spearheaded the growth of that. I was primarily making it grow not just in Texas, but also south of the border, which is where we drew at the Karate Olympics so many of our competitors from Guatemala or Mexico or, you know, the different
Sergio
South
Cabalas.
American countries that would come up.
I think
and,
Sergio Cabalas is a great guy. Yes, he's too.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Sergio Cabalas.
Sergio Cabalas, what a wonderful, wonderful
yeah.
gentleman he was. He passed away, and I miss him a lot. He didn't speak English, and I didn't speak Spanish, but we were able to communicate with each other and became very, very, very close friends. And he taught in Mexico City and would always bring a group of people from Mexico City. And then I don't want to leave out Eric Schumann, who is from Guatemala City, and brought people up from there by the plane full, and it was just an exciting time to be able to bring so many fighters from outside of the United States into the Karate Olympics from our southern border, and not to leave out the Canadians that came too, Scott Hogarth and others like that. Well, there are not any others like Scott Hogarth, but, you know, other Canadians came too.
Yes, sir. Well, Chris, you still there, right, honey? Chris?
What? Yeah.
Okay. I got to ask you a question now. You're one of the, like I said, one of the best fighters you ever had in America. And if I'm not mistaken, Ms. Coy, she received the Joe Louis Eternal Warrior Award, didn't she? She got received one of those?
Yes, that was a great time, too.
What I want to ask you, Chris, is that you've seen the involvement of women in karate, and you've been around some of the great women in karate. What have you seen change in sport karate for women?
Say that again, Gary. I couldn't hear you.
Okay. What have you seen the major change for women in sport karate? Because in the beginning, you know, women were treated like crap. I mean, I know they were prejudiced. They didn't get points. But, you know, you see the involvement. What's the biggest change you see?
You know,
better athletes.
I don't know much about how they were treated. I don't really ever, you know, I saw some of that. But as the years evolved, it was amazing the different levels of athletes. Basically through cross training, different kinds of, you know, cross training, especially in the katas, just amazing athletes.
Yes, ma'am. Well, Joe and George, how was the biggest thing you had to change through the year as you got the tournament after tournament after tournament after tournament? I think, Joe, your tournament ran 50 years, correct?
Well, you may not know, but it's still running. I mean, it's scheduled for June 18th of this year.
Yeah, Mr. Ruth.
It didn't stop just because I left. It continued on. It was 2 years ago where we had, you know, it was the 50th annual, and we had a great celebration that year. George and Chris and so many good people from around the world came, and we called it the gathering of world changers. So we had top fighters from the Battle of Atlanta all over the years and great fighters from the PKA, and then also people who had done a great job as fighters and then went on to do, you know, other things in the sport, whether it was managing schools and training people and training champions, you know, and doing great events like the Houston Olympics. So it was really a magical day. But the 50 Battle of Atlanta number 52, I guess, if it was 2 years ago. George, how much is that? 50 plus two? What is that?
Well, in Texas, it's still 52, but it may be a little bit different in Georgia.
Yeah.
How many years did you run the Karate Olympics, George? How many years was the Karate Olympics? 40 or 50?
What did Joe say? 52? So mine was 53.
Yeah.
Okay.
And since I'm 41 and George is in his, you know, some later decade, then, that it had to go longer than mine.
Okay, well, here's a good question for George first and now one from Joe. What's the craziest moment in sport karate, George? I know, there's been a bunch, but what was your craziest one?
Well, there were so many crazy in Los Angeles, the NBL had their annual World Games. And at that tournament, I'd never seen anything like this before in my life. This guy came up on the stage. He didn't like the way the head referee was calling points, and he certainly wasn't giving them to that guy's student. So the guy came into the ring. I was standing beside the ring just chatting with some friends. This was during the eliminations. Walked up on the stage, got into an argument with the head referee, and punched him out. And he was allowed to stay in the tournament. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe, first of all, that he was able to walk out alive. And not only that, but they allowed him to stay in the tournament. That just was beyond belief to me.
Well, also, George, before I go to Joe, George, you've been known to wear a red glove. And the story is that you were pretty fast with a backhand strike. And you had to put a red glove on so just the judges could see you hit people. Is that a true story or is that kind of a tall tale?
That's the myth, the man, the legend. It was absolutely true. When I first started fighting as a black belt, I mean, I just didn't seem to be able to have anybody call what I knew I was doing. And so I assumed that I was so good and so fast that they just couldn't see it. So in Wichita, Kansas, I went downtown. It was on a Saturday, and I left the tournament, went downtown Wichita, Kansas, and found a women's dress store and bought a pair of red women's gloves, little dress gloves they would wear to church or whatever. And
were those
came back
designed
to
match the red underwear, the red panties that you told me about?
Well, it was right next to the beauty salon that Joe was having his hair done at.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, no. No. I was wearing boxers.
I taped that glove onto my right hand. I didn't have anything on the other hand. So when competition started, I stepped in the ring, and the head referee said, "What is that?" And I said, "That's a glove." And he said, "Why do you have it?" And I said, "So you can see my technique." It drew his attention and drew the other guy's attention. They were looking for it, which is half of winning, is to get the judges to be looking for your technique. Anyway, they looked for it, and I was able to make the finals of that event. And from that time forward, I was in the fortunate enough to be in the winner's circle most of the time instead of almost never.
And I think the red pumps you wore in those events probably brought some interest too, didn't they?
Joe, it took you that long to think of that. It doesn't count. You have to be able to come back a lot quicker than that.
Well,
I've got one for you, Joe.
Nope, 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 nope. Took too long.
Legend has it that Michael Jackson was in the audience.
Okay, years ago, I put pictures up of you bowing into somebody at a tournament when you were young with the afro. And then the next picture, this guy's laying out.
He's just never going to stop on the afro, is he?
Okay, I will. But this guy was this guy was knocked out cold. Tell me the story, but I can't remember all of it. Why'd you knock him out for it? And this is a point tournament, not full contact, which you're known for. But this is a point tournament in the 70s. You remember those two pictures?
Yeah, I do. It was just a vendetta that this guy and I had had for a few years. We were brown belts together at the same time. And then it was a he said kind of thing. And there we were in Chattanooga, and we were fighting each other. And the score was 3-0, and I was ahead. And he stuck his chin out and tapped it. And one of my good students over there looked at another one and said, I don't think he should have done that. And so he rushed in, reached out and grabbed me with his left hand and pulled his right hand way back like he was going to hit me really hard. And just as he did that, he ran into a nice straight left hand, and it knocked the lens out of his glasses, which cut his face, and then the lens went up and almost hit the rafters in the gym as he went down and rested on the floor. And that was that would also qualify as one of my favorite crazy moments sport karate.
I'll put that picture up again. It's a big fun. But you know, the neat thing about hanging out with you guys and knowing you guys on a personal basis, I've got to meet some incredible people, and you guys are actually good friends with some of these people, so I'd like to talk a little bit about them. First person, just talk to me about your relationship with Mr. Norris, Chuck Norris. You go first, George.
Well, I met Chuck Norris in California originally at a meeting with Ed Parker, was trying to put together a nationwide circuit of competitive teams, and he had invited from Alan Steen and Pat Burleson. He didn't actually invite me, but Pat and Alan insisted that I was able to go. And then Chuck Norris was invited to come, and Bob Wall wasn't invited either, but Chuck insisted that Bob be able to come, because Bob and I were both brown belts, which was, you know, that would might as well not have been any belt if back in those days, according to black belts. And so we were there really because of our business acumen, not our martial arts skills. And so that's where I first met Chuck. And then the next time I saw him was in Dallas at Alan Steen's tournament. And we just knew each other over the years. And so he was one of the people that developed a fighting part of that. I can't remember the name of it, where you had the teams from Los Angeles and Houston and New York. Thomas LaPuppet had a team in New York, and Benny Yukitas was on a team from L.A. and so forth. And so Chuck was part of that organization. And then we just knew each other over the years. I went to California some time ago. Chris and I did both, and to visit some friends out there. And we trained with Chuck Norris in his house in Tarzana, and then trained with another guy in the Israeli arts of Krav Maga, which nobody even heard of at that time. So there were. We just go back a long, long way. When you've known someone like I have, and like Chuck and I have known each other for over 50 years, people always are asking, well, what's he like? And I said, what you see on the screen is what he's like. He's a genuine person, a genuinely kind and person, but you don't want to really mess with him. and because he's as good as it looks like he is.
Joe, come out. You'll like to sit with Colin. I know you're very close to him, too.
Well, I met him at a tournament up in Madison Square Garden. He was just getting ready to retire as I was making my way onto this what we used to call the national scene. And it was just I introduced myself to him, and he was really nice, as George can tell you, just always just cream of the earth, and just said, come and train with me in Los Angeles. And I thought that was really a special invitation. And so a couple of years later, I was able to get out there. And when I got out there, he had just kind of broken through in the acting world. He was really busy. So he turned me over to Pat Johnson, and Pat Johnson kind of became my mentor. But then Chuck came to a number of our Battles of Atlanta and a number of our big PKA events over the years. And, you know, as you know, I couldn't say it any better than the way George said it. He's just a real, you know, sincere and good person.
Yes, sir. Well, I got to ask you, Joe, how crazy is Billy Waller?
How crazy is who?
How crazy is Bill Waller?
Well, my friend John Keating used to use a term that a person would be crazy as a road lizard. What I knew about Bill Wallace was that he had this side, which everybody used to call kind of a howdy doody side, where he was really, you know, seemed like he was, you know, happy go lucky, but the things he hated most were losing and having someone hit him. And when you were facing him in the ring, you would see the whites on all four sides of his eyes, you know, so he was really, really intense. I just posted the last few days, Facebook brings it up at this time every year, and I posted it. And this rematch that he and I did on ESPN 10 years after we did the title fight. And you can see at the as that fight went on, the further it went, the more he was trying to hurt me. And so I'm still pretty upset about that. And I'm going to do something about it one day. George is going to help.
We're going to write a very serious letter to Bill Wallace.
Yes.
That's what we're going to do.
Yes, we're going to tell him, don't hurt me anymore. I like
that's
that, George.
Fun.
That I wish I had thought of that.
Now, both of you guys are very close to someone very, 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 very important to sport karate. He was the first heavyweight world champion. We lost him a few years ago, and then, Joe, you helped me celebrate his legacy. And Jeff Smith did, coming to Houston, and we did a big video of him. We're talking about Mr. Joe Lewis. Tell me your relationship with him, Joe, and then I'm asking George.
Everything not everything, but the main things I ended up working on the Battle of Atlanta and PKA were all grew in the beginning because of Joe Lewis. And Mitchell Bobro at his memorial service described it best. He said that most people would not realize that as they associated with Joe Lewis at any level, what a big difference that would make in their lives. And so that's kind of a short way to say it. I started writing a book. I think I shared this with George when he was in Atlanta last year. I started writing a book in 1999. And by the time we got to 2011, I had written three paragraphs. I was really moving along, and I was having what they call writer's block for, 12 years. And so Joe Lewis came into Washington, D.C. for June Ree's 80th birthday. And on his 80th birthday, June Ree was doing 100 push-ups, in 60 seconds. And Joe Lewis was, meanwhile, at the back table there trying to, as always, bringing attention to himself. And he was having everybody test their hand strength on the things that he always carried with him, to squeeze. And that night we all went out to Hilton. It was in the rain, and Alan Steen was there, and George, were you there for that 80th birthday? There were so many people from Texas there. I can't remember if you were there or not.
You would remember.
At Junior's 80th birthday. And anyway, Joe Lewis was talking to everybody at the end, and I was just watching his hands move, and it was like he was conducting an orchestra. And he would stop in the middle of it and look at me and say, "You never really liked me, did you, Corley?" And I said, "Yeah, liked you a lot, man." He would go on and talk and talk. And anyway, the next day I wrote 7 chapters. You know, whatever he did that night just broke it loose. So when he passed, I had written some things about what I felt was going on there at the service and so on. I was really moved by it. That feeling carried us on to being able to create that Joe Lewis Eternal Warrior Award, you know, the next year at the Battle of Atlanta.
Which we cherish that. It's very, very honorable. Now, George, didn't Mr. Lewis win the Cry Olympics 1 year?
Yeah, he did. You know, Joe Lewis came along at a time, actually, with Chuck Norris. Chuck was the wear the white hat, so polite to everyone. Joe was the bad boy. You know, he would point to a spot he was going to hit you, and then hit you twice in that spot, and then once in another spot. He was I don't know if you can call it arrogant if you can do it, and he could do it. But he changed. He really had an impact and changed the whole idea about karate fighters because he was in an incredible physical shape. I mean, he stayed in shape year round and was always ready to fight anytime, any place, anywhere. And he worked over and over. When they had that school in Sherman Oaks, he and Chuck Norris had a school there, and actually Pat Burleson was there too when he lived in California for a few months. And they had a Makawa striking board that Joe Lewis used to punch that board. It was wrapped with raw rope. And if you knew Joe Lewis and you ever looked at his knuckles, you would know that guy was serious about hitting something. But I just was always so impressed with his self-confidence, backed by the fact that he had incredible skills and was always ready to share. Most people don't realize that Joe Lewis was a teacher at heart and was always ready to share his skills and how he did things.
Yes, sir. Well, you know, we had another friend of ours that passed away a couple weeks ago that we were very close to, and Mr. Jim Harrison. What was your relationship with him, Joe?
You know, he's one of those guys. Jim Harrison was one of those guys when I first met him. You know, he spoke so softly and was so darn deadly. And, you know, I was always a big fan of the Clint Eastwood characters and, you know, starting with the spaghetti westerns all the way through Dirty Harry. So I always liked the idea that someone would walk softly and talk softly and carry a big .44. And so Jim was like that person to me when I would visit him in Kansas City. And hear him, I just had this sense that there was that real calm on the surface of a powerful storm of some kind. So he was always a really, we didn't get to spend a whole lot of time together, but I felt like he was a kindred spirit. And when we inducted him into the Battle of Atlanta Centurion Club, it was a special moment because he and Bernard Carrick, you know, who had been the police commissioner in New York City during 9/11. He was Giuliani's police commissioner. He and Jim Harrison got their picture taken, in fact, with still a picture that I really like a lot with its Jim Harrison, Bernard Carrick, and John Corcoran all together. And, you know, when we lost him, we We actually lost him on February 22nd. My birthday was the day before, and then I think that's the date next year when Carol is going to have the, you know, in memory of Jim event, because it had to be put off because of this coronavirus stuff. But it is really special human being. I mean, I can't say that too many times.
Well, our love to Carol and Sean and Tor and Tony and everybody from the Harris family. Now, George, what's your feelings about Jim Harrison? God bless you, peace.
Jim Harrison, I won't be able to say anything that hasn't been said about him. He was a fearsome fighter. I met him actually when I was a green belt, and he came down to Houston from Kansas City to fight in a little tournament there, and he got second place because he got disqualified. Shocker, I know. But one of the things I learned that night from Jim Harrison was he as soon as the tournament was over, he got on a phone and called the local newspaper in Kansas City and talked about the tournament and how great it was, and that he was the first runner-up champion. he didn't have second place. He was the first runner-up champion. I have to give him actually, Jim Harrison and Fred Wren were fighting each other in Dallas, and I was watching them closely because they were both fearsome people, and each of them respected the other one so much that they didn't particularly want to get in to grab your uniform and beat the crap out of you. So although they would if they could get away with it, but you can't. Neither one of those guys are going to get away with it. So both of them were using their front lead hand back fist, and that's where I first saw that being used. I'm sure other people did it, but not with the skill that both those guys did. And so from that moment on is when I started working on that, and it became my bread and butter technique. Like everybody has one that's probably their favorite, but that was mine. And Jim and I grew close over the years. We saw each other at many tournaments. I'm going to miss him dearly. He was a true representative. If people talk about the blood and guts era, they're talking about Jim Harrison.
Well, we're all going to miss him deeply. But, you know, a few years back, we had the grant money for the Sport Car Museum. You made this man stay in your house, and you and Chris, and he was the first superstar of sport karate. I'm talking about Mr. Mike Stone. Joe, what's your relationship with Mike?
I haven't had a chance to spend much time with Mike Stone, but when the breakthrough year for the Battle of Atlanta was in the fourth year, 1974, and that year when Chuck and Pat Johnson came, they brought Mike Stone with them. They brought Tadashi Yamashita. Bob Wall came with them. Mike Foster was here in the South, and got to spend some time with Mike. And he sent me a nice note a couple of years ago, said he really missed my sarcasm, and I didn't know really what he meant. But
I'm sure it was
a nice note from him.
Well, George, Mike got to stay with you at the grand opening of the museum. Tell me about your relationship with Mike.
Yeah, he did. He stayed on my boat, not the one that I have now, but the one that I had before this one, and spent a few days on it. We got to know each other closer than we had before. I first met him in Los Angeles at Chuck Norris's karate school. And that they were talking about the, some people call the reverse back kick, where you are a spinning back kick. And Mike had not really had any experience with it. So they put a kicking bag and sat it in a folding chair, and somebody was holding it, and they were showing Mike how to do that kick. And, he did it about twice, kind of slow, and then he did a turn back kick into that bag so quick and so hard I mean, the bag doubled up. I couldn't believe that he could do that so quickly. He was Mike Stone is one of those people that came into the martial arts as a certified top athlete. He was a high school all-star football player in California. So he brought those skills with him into the martial arts because, as some people may know, he didn't train very long before he got into black belt competition, less than 6 months, actually. And it was his athleticism that took him right away. And the fact that he could hit so hard, because he's not really a big guy, but he could hit you. He could hit people so hard it didn't matter whether they were heavyweight or lightweight. He can match a heavyweight's punching power and kicking power.
Amazing. Well, we got one more old timer that you hang out with, and you hang out with him a lot. I'm talking world champion Jeff Smith. Joe, tell me about Mr. Smith.
Well, you know, I met Jeff Smith and Pat Worley up at the Henry Cho tournament up there in New York. And, you know, it was a tournament that I just basically went to by myself when I went up there to compete when I first started leaving the South to fight. And I don't know why we talk about it once in a while. We don't know really why it was we even started talking. Next thing I know, I'm in his VW van, and he's driving like a maniac down the streets of New York. And, you know, just something about that trip made me think that he was just crazy enough that I should be friends with him and try to help him stay alive a few more years. Then, as it turns out, when we started doing when he won the first world title out there at the PKA event, the next year, Joe Louis was supposed to fight this Kareem Allah on the Thrill in Manila for Don King, and then Ross Scott dislocated Joe Louis's shoulder, so they turned to June Rhee, and June Rhee put Jeff Smith up at 179 pounds to fight the 220 pounder, and so we, Asa Gordon and all of us, helped Jeff get ready for that. And you know, it's just been one of those friendships. I called him the other day in a post that he's been to me what Val Kilmer was to Wyatt Earp in Tombstone. You know, he's been my Huckleberry.
Yeah. Well, you know, George, he's a Texas boy. And you watched him grow
up
in Texas, and he went to Washington, D.C. and worked for Mr. Rhee. And did you ever encounter with him and judge him in those early days?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You know, Jeff went to school down in the valley of Texas, down in Kingsville, Texas. And that's where he started kind of learning martial arts was. And those days was kind of a hand-down thing. The guy that knew more than you is the guy that you studied, you know, you would train with, and they would pass what they knew, and then you'd find somebody else that knew something different. And so when Jeff made black belt, then June Rhee had told him, come up to D.C. and I'll put you to work up there teaching for me. So Jeff, on his way to D.C., came through Houston, and I had this little small tournament I held there in Houston, and Jeff entered his first black belt tournament. And I mean, there were no easy fights in Texas. I mean, that's just the fact. Ed Daniels was one of the ones that Jeff fought, and he was able to get past Big Ed purely on guts. And then I don't remember who else he fought. Then he fought Jim Buten for the grand champion. Jim Buten won that match, which is probably the last time Jeff Smith ever lost one. I don't know. I mean, the guy was just is phenomenal. And, you know, and Joe mentioned that he met Jeff Smith and Pat Worley up there. And Jeff being the really nice person he did, called Pat Worley, who was working for me down in Houston while he was going to school, and said, come up to D.C. This guy's going to pay you a lot more than he does. So Pat said, okay, he packed up and went up to D.C. and went to work for June Reed, too. But Pat Worley is a phenomenon. He has raised the bar so high, it's not, you can't even see the bar, it's so high. He was a world-class fighter in karate, and then trained in jiu-jitsu and made black belt and won the world championship in jiu-jitsu. And the guy's, I don't know, 100-and-something years old now. I don't know. He's plenty old.
You know what's really cool, George and Joe? You mentioned Jim Newton and Ed Daniel. I talked to them today. God bless you guys.
Well,
if I hadn't known you guys, I wouldn't be able to talk to all these little legends and incredible people of Fort Clyden. I want to ask you guys a couple of last questions.
Hey,
I got
Professor.
Yes.
Professor, this is Wolverine. I've been listening, but I got to get off here because I got a meeting getting ready to start in California. So I got to hop off. But I just want to say,
buddy,
it's been awesome listening to these two guys.
Isn't it cool?
I think the world of both of them. Yeah, it's really cool.
We're going to hear from you tonight too. So I look forward to talking to you.
Oh, he's working
soon
on a movie, Joe, called The Coward.
Wow.
Yeah, Mr. Corley, I'll call you up and talk to you about it. We may even get you in doing some things with it. We've got a 5-movie deal, so we got a lot of cool stuff going on. So
cool.
And that's what we're
George
talking about right now. I think
too.
Things are going to speed up. Yeah. And we can get him in there, too. We got, like I say, we got a lot of – right now things are, you know, they're thinking things are going to break loose and they're going to lift the filming ban. So right now we're in double-time mode,
Severin,
trying to get everything
Michael
going.
McCauley, AJ Kelly,
yeah.
Ernie, Ernest Miller, Kathy Sewell.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of cool people in it.
Your timing is absolutely really good because I'm just now getting out of my contract with MGM, so I don't have an obligation to them for any more movies.
That's awesome. Timing is everything.
It is
everything. I got a young whippersnapper in there. Tell me about your relationship with one of the young historians who's really been a big supporter of the Fort Clyden Museum, Jamie Cashin. George, you go first. What's Jamie Cashin to you?
Jamie Cashin is a very, very close friend of mine. I've known him since he was a teenage boy. He is just a ball of fire. He's endless energy, and he's the most giving, real person that I know, quite frankly. I mean, he sponsors a village in Africa. He sponsors the clinic there. He goes there every year. He travels across the country on his dime to help anybody anywhere. He's just a first-class person all the way down the line, and I wouldn't trade my relationship with him for anything.
Yes. Now, Joe, have you got to know Jamie at all? Pretty good?
Yeah, you know, he's been a terrific host to us, you know, and I saw, you know, the way he has supported, you know, in every way that you could humanly support somebody, his instructor. And, you know, when you see that happen, then I just inferred all the things that George just said about him. He's just really a giving guy, and I love his humor, and you know, just I love the houses that he buys, and you know, and the Corvettes and all that stuff. I like his choice in all those things.
I got one really important question. You guys are the history general of the Fort Clyden Museum, and you've been to a couple of the living legends and the events that we do. George, you come every year. How important is the history? And this is for Chris, too. How important is the history that we keep it in front of everybody and we tell them about the icons and the pioneers like Joe Lewis and Mike Stone and these young people like Jamie Cash and people that really care? How important is that? Joe, you go first.
You want me to go first, you said?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
How important is it,
well,
the history?
You know, I think the history is really important. You know, I'm a little bit cynical at this. You know, now that I'm entering the fifth decade of my time on the planet, I'm a little cynical about where the learning curve is in America.
You're 39 years old forever. Aren't you 39
No,
41. Forever?
I'm 41. 41.
Okay, forever.
And I think the learning curve has changed a good bit over the years. You know, I can imagine there may be baseball players that win the Cy Young Award these days who don't know who Cy Young was, you know. So history seems to begin for people now when they entered it as opposed to, you know, what came before. It's a shame we don't have a lot of great video and stuff from the good old days where you could actually sit down and take
Would
people through it.
You guys remember
but,
Ernie Libb and Ken Knudsen and Ernie Libb? They gave me over 120 hours of film from the 60s for the museum. Those guys did, and they're both gone.
Is that right?
What? God bless. Yes, sir.
Have you DVD'd it yet?
DVD. I'm working on it as we speak. Yes, sir. George, tell me how important the history is to be kept alive.
You know, Joe hit the nail right on the head when he said that for most people, their karate knowledge begins when they began. And you really have to understand how this industry, which it is now, how this industry was built. And it's not that old. 50 years in the scope of things is not a long, long time. But in the 50 or 60 years that we have been putting this industry together, so much has changed. And I always like I have a philosophy that I use, and it's called, none of us could see so far if we were not standing on the shoulders of giants. So never forget who came before you, because that's why you're able to do what you can do.
Wow. Thank you so much for your wisdom.
That's a great way to say it.
Absolutely. Well,
Gerald.
Yes, ma'am.
I have to say, too, that sometimes George has always talked about the museum and how grateful he is for you doing it. You know, he said it's something that needs to be done, and he loves it and thinks it's a great thing you're doing. And he said there's so many people that wouldn't take the time to do it, and he tells me all the time how grateful he is for you.
Well, I've got heroes like Joe Corley and George Minshew. I mean, come on, man. I got motivation. I mean, golly, guys, you guys realize I got Joe Lewis's black belt, Junior Reed's black belt, Mike Stone's black belt, J. Pat Bolton's black belt, Bruce Brucey's black belt. I got even Ronald Duncan, the ninja guy from New York's black belt. I mean, these guys trust me with things that they didn't just wrap around their waist, because they wore every day on and off. And I can't thank you guys enough for being my heroes and being a part of what we do. And for tonight and all the guests that we've put together in 5 years, I want to say thank you so much, Mr. Minshew, and Supreme Grandmaster Joe Corey. Thank you, sir.
There you go. Did you hear that, George? Supreme Grandmaster.
One last
question, but he didn't say the exalted Supreme Grandmaster.
One last question from all you guys. Okay, what do you think about all these Hall of Fames and all these 13th degree black belts that are appearing on the internet? Is it crazy or is it crazy? Any one of you?
Well,
I'm going to tell you about the degrees, Gary, and it's a very simple system I follow. Whatever degree you are, I'm one degree higher, so we don't need to talk about any number.
Okay. That's a good way to say it. How about you, Mr. Corey? What do you think about all these Hall of Fame and this thing that's going on in America where you got to pay for your fame and buy your – it's crazy.
I think our sport has just had so – you know, we had an era there where you had some great magazines, Black Belt and Karate Illustrated, that were on the stands, and you know, I'm sure Mr. Minshew feels the same way, where you can actually pick up a magazine and read about yourself and other people, and that kind of connected us. And I think these Hall of Fames maybe take the place of that era where we were able to actually see and hear about other things. And sadly, there are people who created an industry by promoting people that might not have ever had a chance to be seen in the magazines. And, you know, from my perspective, I don't really feel badly about it in any way. I just try not to participate myself.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Minshew, you and Chris, wear your life preserver, because you live on a boat. And Mr. Corley, you take care of Mr. Smith on his motorcycle and feed lots of hamburgers to Bill. And you guys, God bless you for the interview tonight. You guys are the best. Thank you so much for being my hero. God bless you.
Thanks
guys.
For having me.
Good night. Good night, okay. Joe.
Good night, George. Good night, Chris. See you guys
bye,
soon,
y'all.
I hope. All right.
And good night to Calabash.
Yes. On behalf of the AMMA Radio Network and Jesse Bowen and myself and the Sport Karting Museum, we had the amazing George Minshew, Joe Corley, and the lovely Chris Minshew. And for more information about the Sport Karting Museum, go to www.sportkartingmuseumarchive.com. And, you know, I'm so excited about the people that we're going to do. We've got so many people coming up in the next coming weeks, and we'll get through this pandemonium thing that America is going through, and we'll be back stronger. And remember to listen to the words of Mr. Corley and Mr. Minshew about keeping your students in line, keeping them informed, and communicating with them. And go to Mr. Oliver's website page and go to Mr. Minshew and ask some questions, because let me tell you something about these guys, Mr. Corley and Mr. Minshew. They've been in business for a long time. Mr. Minshew and I, we actually run 8 schools. Mr. Corley runs schools all in Atlanta. These guys are smart, so listen to what they have to say and take their advice. On behalf of the AMMAA Network, God bless you guys. And as we always say, mahalo and aloha. Good night, everybody.
You did great, George. You're so sweet about everyone. It was great.
Ain't he cool, Chris?
What?
I guess Gary heard you. I guess you heard her, huh?
What did he say?
He said you're so cool, Chris.